Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Just how tarnished were the business, political, and romantic affairs of the biggest names of the Gilded Age? And was one major headline, why was one major headline maker shot down in the prime of life? While we remember names like Cornelius Vanderbilt, Boss Tweed, and Jay Gould better than Jim Fisk today, Fisk's financial exploits regularly made headlines in the wild years that followed the Civil War. And if his soured affair with self-proclaimed actress Josie Mansfield titillated millions of newspaper readers, the trials that followed Fisk's shooting by Mansfield's new lover kept them absolutely riveted. H.W. Brands is Dixon Allen Anderson Centennial Professor of History at the University of Austin. He tells the story in his new book, The Murder of Jim Fisk for the Love of Josie Mansfield, A Tragedy of the Gilded Age. H.W., welcome back to Think.
Delighted to be with you.
So Fisk was born in 1835 in Vermont to fairly humble circumstances. How did he earn enough money and enough prestige to attract the attention of people like Dan Drew and Jay Gould?
In the United States during the Civil War, there were plenty of opportunities for speculation. A person didn't have to have a lot of capital to make a lot of money. The Union Army was engaged in heavy procurement. The government was spending lots of money to make sure that the Union side would win. That raised the price of all sorts of commodities and other issues on Wall Street. So somebody who had an eye for an opportunity, who had a plausible story, who could borrow money, could leverage that borrowed money, and make a lot of money quite quickly.
So he traded in cotton, he traded in cattle?
He traded in all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. Some of the trading was probably illegal, but laws were being bent amid the war, and he wasn't the only one by any means.
Yeah, one of the things that's interesting is that he would when he was selling cattle, he would fill them up with water so that they would weigh more?
Well, this was an old trick that was actually pioneered by one of his partners, Daniel Drew. And the term stock watering arose that way, and it originally referred to real livestock and real water. What they would do is they would feed the cattle salt just before the cattle were being sold. So the cattle would get very thirsty, fill up with water, and they'd look fat and happy, and they'd command a higher price than they would have otherwise.
So what sort of partnership did he have with Jay Gould?
The two of them made a speculating team. Gould was the brains behind the operation. He was the one who conceived the plans for, well, taking over the Erie Railroad. The Erie Railroad was a source of great speculation and battles among various financiers, and ultimately to corner the U.S. gold market at the time. Gold was both a precious commodity, a precious metal, and it was the basis for the American money supply. And so anybody who controlled the gold supply would have enormous influence, enormous power over the American economy. And it was Gould's idea that he, starting alone, but Fisk talked his way into it, could purchase enough advance contracts for the delivery of gold to gain what was called a corner on the gold market. Mm-hmm. They would actually be owed more gold than existed on the market. And so those people who owed them gold and couldn't pay would have to settle on terms favorable to Gould and Fisk. And this was a plot that they hatched during the summer of 1869. And they came very close to pulling it off.
And then was it the U.S. Treasury came in and sort of added more gold back into the market?
The wild card in all of their calculations was whether or not the U.S. Treasury would enter the gold market. The Treasury had more gold in its vaults than anybody else. If the U.S. Treasury stayed out of the market, then Gould and Fisk's plan could probably succeed. But if the Treasury entered the market, then it would certainly fail. Now, President Grant at the time and his Treasury Secretary men and George Boutwell were, for the most part, believers that the private market ought to operate without government influence. And their feeling was that if the government got involved, it would be a mess trying to pick one winner from another and try to influence things in that way. They were very much attuned to the operations of the free market. But as the price of gold went higher and higher, and as both speculators and, in this context, you could call honest merchants, people who needed the gold for legitimate purposes rather than just bidding on price to see if it would go up, as they became more and more nervous, and then they began to panic as when it looked like they couldn't get the gold they needed, at the very last minute, the U.S. Treasury, President Grant, ordered the Treasury to sell the Treasury's gold. It broke the gold corner. The price of gold fell from 165 to 135 in a matter of minutes. And fortunes vanished in that time. There was uproar on Wall Street. Speculators chased Gould and Fisk from the gold room on Wall Street to their headquarters, the headquarters of the Erie Railroad on 23rd Street, with mayhem on their minds. And if Gould and Fisk had not barricaded themselves behind the heavy oak doors of their office and surrounded the building with a gang of hired thugs, they probably would have been swinging from a lamppost by evening.
Now, the story of how they got control of that railroad is interesting as well, including an escape that honestly is worthy of like an Ocean's 11 movie. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
The Erie Railroad was called the Scarlet Woman of Wall Street because of the way the Erie Railroad was sold back and forth from one speculating group to another. The Erie Railroad seemed to have no virtue. She just went to whoever would pay the highest price. And it was an important railroad. It was the most important link between New York City and Lake Erie, which meant the interior of the country. So it was a main thoroughfare of transportation, in addition to being the object of speculation. And there were competing camps that fought for control of the Erie, just as in recent years, various competitors have fought for control of one corporation today and another. Mm-hmm. One of the differences between then and now, though, is no one knew in 1866, 1867, 1868, as all this played out, how many shares of the Erie Railroad were on the market because there were no federal reporting requirements. Hmm. Only the directors knew how many shares there were, and they often weren't telling.
And they were on pieces of hard paper. Excuse me for interrupting.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The shares were written on paper. They were ownership certificates. And if the board of directors decided to issue new shares, they could do so. If the shares were legal, that was fine. If the shares were illegal, it was often impossible to tell. Hmm. The only way you could tell they were new is you could, and the brokers actually did smell the ink to see if it smelled new. But the result of this was that people who owned existing shares had no idea if their ownership of the corporation was being diluted by the issue of new shares. Shares were exchanged, but whether they were old shares or new shares was very hard to tell. And as the competition developed between a group headed by Jay Gould, Jim Fisk, and Daniel Drew on one side, who were clever and ambitious, and on the other side was a group headed by Cornelius Vanderbilt, who was ruthless and very, very rich. And the two of them fought back and forth for control of the Erie. Vanderbilt did not have a seat on the board of directors. Fisk, Gould, and Drew did. And as the directorship of the corporation, at one critical moment when it looked as though some bogus shares that they had been putting out on the market were going to be seized and they were going to be arrested by the New York authorities, not that the New York authorities were particularly concerned with law and order. In fact, this group had been bribed by Cornelius Vanderbilt. They decided that they would suddenly relocate the headquarters of the corporation from New York City to New Jersey. So they grabbed the books, they grabbed the files, they grabbed, the numbers vary, $6 to $8 million in cash, and they fled across the Hudson River.
So they had their cash like in suitcases or trunks, or was it mm-hmm. big bags with the dollar signs on them?
Yes, and in fact, a policeman stopped them in the street. And I said, what are you doing with all this money? And Fisk, who was a very plausible fellow, explained that they were just relocating the offices. He handed the cop $50 and he let him go on their way. And they made it across the Hudson, which put them beyond the reach of New York authorities. New Jersey, then as now, had laws that were quite favorable to the incorporation of companies. And New Jersey was quite happy to see them because they would bring business, they would pay taxes in New Jersey. And so they threatened to reincorporate the business in New Jersey. But as is the case today, when people are used to New York and they go to New Jersey, they feel they're living in exile. In fact, they did live in exile for several weeks before Gould managed to bribe enough members of the New York State Legislature to change the laws to allow them back into New York. And then Daniel Drew, meanwhile, the partner of Fisk and Gould, tried to go behind the back of Fisk and Gould to cut a deal with Vanderbilt and leave Drew in control of the Erie. Well, Fisk and Gould got wind of what Drew was doing. They burst in on Vanderbilt and Drew just as the two were about to conclude the bargain, and they, by some combination of shame and coercion, got Vanderbilt to deal with them instead of Drew. So Vanderbilt and Fisk and Gould settled. Vanderbilt got his money back that he had invested in the corporation, and Fisk and Drew and Gould wound up in control of the Erie.
And Drew ended up with nothing?
Drew went off to retirement. He had always claimed to be a very pious soul, so he spent much of the rest of his time and such money as he had endowing a theological seminary in his name.
It cannot have hurt that Fisk was in tight with William Tweed, that the world knows as Boss Tweed. How did those two get to be good friends?
Well, they were kindred spirits, and one could say partners in crime, although you have to hesitate to use the word crime here, because one of the things about the scandals of the Gilded Age, perhaps the most scandalous thing about them all, was that for the most part they weren't illegal. The kind of shenanigans that Fisk and Gould were up to were not illegal. Now, Tweed was a different character, because Tweed was engaged in garden variety corruption. But this garden grew massive plants. The corruption that finally brought Tweed down was on the scale of tens of millions of dollars, at a time when $1 million was a lot of money. And the most egregious manifestation of Tweed's bilking was a county courthouse in New York City that's still there, that had been under construction for years. Something like $40 million had been spent on its construction, and it was still incomplete. Now, no one could tell where the money had gone. No one could tell whose bank accounts were being padded. Eventually, some investigative journalists did some work, uncovered the story, and they broke the story. In fact, it ran in the New York Times. But instead of breaking the story all at once in a big spectacular piece, the publisher of the Times decided that he would dribble out the information bit by bit and extend the circulation boost to the newspaper. So New Yorkers, who had guessed that Tweed was probably corrupt, now were treated to a litany of his corruption released week by week over the course of a year.
And he was doing things in constructing that building like on the books was each window of this building cost $8,000.
What he would do was to have contractors vastly overcharge the city and the county for the construction. And for the $8,000 windows, well, the contractor wouldn't get $8,000. The contractor would get $8,000 and kick half of it back to Tweed and his friends. So it was the standard kind of kickback you see in all sorts of public procurement from then until now. But it was on a scale that dwarfed anything New Yorkers had seen. And they thought they were pretty inured to this kind of thing.
Yeah, and it was finally so big that even Tweed's powerful connections really did nothing to rescue him at this point.
Well, it's funny how these things work, because as powerful as Tweed was, he always had enemies. Mm-hmm. There were competing groups within New York City. And then there were also competing groups in New York State. And what brought Tweed down was a combination of the New York Times, which was engaged in a circulation battle with the several other major daily newspapers in New York. And the New York Times was a little bit miffed that it had missed out on the previous big scandal, one surrounding the construction of the Transcontinental Railroad, that came out just before the Tweed Ring was uncovered. And so the Times wanted to uncover that. And then in addition, there was a man named Samuel Tilden who wanted to make a run for New York governor and wanted to develop a reputation as the crime buster.
My guest this hour is H.W. Brands. He's Dixon Allen Anderson Centennial Professor of History at the University of Texas at Austin and author of the new book, The Murder of Jim Fisk for the Love of Josie Mansfield, A Tragedy of the Gilded Age. We'll resume the conversation in a moment. If you'd like to join us, get on the line now. The number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. This hour, we're speaking with H.W. Brands, who is Dixon Allen Anderson Centennial Professor of History at the University of Texas at Austin and author of the new book, The Murder of Jim Fisk for the Love of Josie Mansfield, A Tragedy of the Gilded Age. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. So let's get back here to Fisk. We should say that for a man of quite considerable proportions, from the moment he became wealthy, he really, really liked to dress the part. Can you tell us a little bit about his regular attire?
It's hard to liken him to anybody today in terms of his attire, but in the general impression that he gave, he probably seemed more like Donald Trump than anybody else, a person who wanted to draw attention to himself. He wore very colorful clothes. So to wear bright red suits was nothing for him. He had suits of actually several colors. He wore diamond rings on several of his fingers and diamond studs on his shirt. He had his hair, in this respect he does remind me of Trump, he had his hair done just so. He had naturally sort of strawberry blonde hair, and he had it curled into ringlets that were positioned around his forehead. He had a chubby face, but a very florid face. He was quite expressive. He always had a big, heavy cigar in his hand, and he was the kind of person who just insisted on attracting the attention of everyone in the room. When Fisk was around, everybody knew it.
And he had a spectacular mustache.
Oh, yes. Well, mustaches in those days, this is something Americans just don't do the way they used to. Facial hair was spectacular in the 19th century, and it goes back. You can look at Civil War generals, of course, and this was the era right after the Civil War, but Civil War generals had, some of them had beards that went down to the middle of their chest. What they're called sideburns in men were named for General Ambrose Burnside in the war. And presidents, Abraham Lincoln had a beard. Presidents had beards up through the end of the 19th century. But Gould had a very nice mustache, carefully manicured, just like his hair, just like his fingernails, just like every bit about him.
He liked to draw attention even in where he situated the headquarters of the Erie Railroad was an interesting choice.
Jim Fisk was an impresario as much as he was a speculator, a businessman. He should have run a circus. In fact, a lot of people thought that was the way he ran his business affairs because he always seemed to want to be the person leading the circus. And when he and Jay Gould gained control of the Erie Railroad, Fisk decided that they needed a new headquarters for the railroad, something that suited the grandeur of the road. It turned out that there was a new, relatively new, year-old opera house on the corner of 8th Avenue and 23rd Street in New York. It was called the Pike, named for Samuel Pike, its owner, Pike's Opera House. And it was a lavish affair. It was the finest in New York. And Fisk thought this would be a great place for the headquarters of a major railroad corporation. Gould asked him, what in the world was he thinking? Why would they want a place like that? Well, it just so happened it was a big enough building that they had offices upstairs. And Fisk thought, well, we can own the opera house. We can run the opera. We can put on shows, stage productions. And we can have the headquarters of the railroad upstairs.
And
so
Gould
talked Gould into doing it.
Yeah,
and that became the headquarters of the Erie Railroad.
And Gould figured that would keep him busy enough that he'd be out of his hair when he didn't need Fisk around.
This was one of the questions that I have even now is exactly what Jay Gould saw in Jim Fisk. Because Gould, as I said earlier, was the thinker of the two. Gould was the one who had the ideas. But he recognized that he needed a public face, and Fisk suited his purposes very well. Because Fisk looked to be more foolish, more of a buffoon than he really was. And here, one again might well liken him to Donald Trump. Nobody knows whether or how smart Donald Trump is because he's such an actor, he's such a role player, he's become such a character. Well, that was the same way with Jim Fisk. And Gould recognized that he would gain a lot by having a partner that people consistently underestimated. Now, there was another aspect of this, too, that Gould, on occasion, would double-cross Fisk. Fisk, his own partner. Mm-hmm. In fact, in the middle of the attempted gold corner, Gould got wind that the Treasury was going to sell its gold, was going to intervene to break the gold corner. And he learned about this about 12 hours before Fisk did. Now, Gould decided he needed to get out to start selling very quietly. And he knew perfectly well that it would cover his tracks if Fisk, who was known to be his partner, was still buying gold. Well, if Fisk was still loudly and publicly buying gold, then presumably Gould was too. But in fact, Gould was not. And so Gould was silently undercutting Fisk, even while Fisk was maintaining this strong front. So when the market for gold collapsed, Fisk was left holding the bag. Now, at that point, one might have guessed that Fisk and Gould would have a falling out. Apparently, Gould and Fisk came to some sort of understanding, some sort of settlement after the fact. One of the charming things about Jim Fisk was he never seemed to hold a grudge. When he first got to Wall Street, he was swindled by Daniel Drew, who later became his partner. And Fisk simply looked upon it as perhaps an expensive, but nonetheless an important educational experience, because he took the lesson, that's how swindling is done on Wall Street. I'll do the same thing myself at first opportunity.
Well, that ability to be swindled leaves us with the perfect introduction to the character who is mentioned in the title, Josie Mansfield. She was living in some kind of rooming house, called herself an actress, but we should say that that term was applied very liberally in those days.
Actress could mean anything from a street-walking prostitute to a high-priced call girl to an actual actress.
Mm-hmm.
They hung out at theaters, and it was expected that ladies of perhaps loose morals would be seen there. The opera house, aside from housing the Erie Railroad, also had a number of private suites upstairs where theatergoers would consort with some of the actresses after the performances. There were parties that would last until late into the night. And so Josie circulated in that group. Now, she actually did perform on stage apparently a few times, but she was a young woman with no conspicuous talents or resources beyond an ability to ingratiate. And she was introduced to Jim Fisk at a party, and she could tell that Fisk was immediately smitten by her, and she developed a plausible story. She explained that she was trying to make her way, but she had suffered some temporary reverses, and the rooming house where she was staying, her rent was due, but she didn't quite have the money, and Fisk very gallantly offered to provide the rent. And Fisk came over to visit, and Josie said that, well, this wasn't the place that she really hoped to live. She hoped that she would have a nicer place, a place of her own. So the smitten Fisk decided to buy her a house. And she would comment on how smart he was and how he knew so much about investing and the stock market. And he would then give her inside tips, and he would lend her money to buy shares of stock. So he set her up. He made her not exactly a respectable woman. He did, after all, have a wife who lived back in Boston. But from the standards of New York, she seemed to be getting along pretty well.
Now, it appears that he was genuinely interested in Josie. It does not appear that she was interested in anything except his bank book.
There's no question that he developed a fondness for Josie. He was, I'm not sure I could say he was in love with her, but he would have stayed with her. He was not the handsomest man. He was not the most charming man. He was a character. He amused Josie, but he was to Josie mostly a means to an end.
Mm-hmm.
So once she got herself financially secure in her own house with a bank account, with her own stock portfolio, her eye began to wander, and it fell on a younger man. Josie was in her early 20s. Fisk was in his early 30s. And the man upon whom Josie's eye fell was a sometime partner of Fisk, a man named Edward Stokes, Ned Stokes. And Ned Stokes was as handsome as Fisk was not.
He looks like Rob Lowe, actually, in the pictures.
He does, yes. And he also had a history as something of a ne'er-do-well, kind of the darkly attractive guy that certainly appealed to Josie and was entirely different from Jim Fisk. With Jim Fisk, Josie, at the age of 24, sometimes felt like an old married woman. But with Stokes, why Stokes, she felt young and exciting. He was in his late 20s, so he was closer to her in age. And one thing led to another, and he began spending time there, first when Fisk was there, and more time when Fisk was not. And eventually, Josie decided that she had established her financial security and that she would now throw in her lot with Ned Stokes.
Assuming all the while that all the things that Fisk had promised her, he would continue to deliver on, despite the fact that she had essentially cuckolded him for a younger business partner.
I guess it takes a lot of gall to carry out that kind of thing, but she wanted to do it. And here it's difficult to tell how much of this was Josie and how much was Stokes, but it would seem that Josie was the guiding spirit behind this, considering what happened in the denouement. But Josie somehow thought that she could essentially throw over Fisk, but still talk Fisk into supporting her financially. And at first she thought she could do it just by flashing her eyelashes at him. He went along for a while, but gradually said, no, this isn't going to work. So then she decided, well, okay, if flirtation wouldn't work and appealing to his heart, well, then she would have to appeal to his pocketbook and perhaps his sense of shame, because she had cannily been keeping his love letters. He had been writing letters to her, and the letters would express his undying devotion to her, how he wanted to see her that evening, how he had never felt toward any other woman the way he felt toward her. The letters apparently, or at least possibly, had information about other important figures. Boss Tweed, of whom we've spoken. Boss Tweed spent a lot of time hanging out with Jim Fisk. And in fact, hanging out with Jim Fisk and Josie Mansfield. And Josie Mansfield would have heard the stories that Tweed had and exactly who was being bribed and how much was being paid. So Josie quite clearly knew more about Tweed than Tweed was comfortable with. And it was thought among those people to whom Josie eventually offered the letters for publication, some of the New York tabloids, that the letters would include damning information on Boss Tweed, who was, from the standpoint of public policy and public law, a much bigger fish than Jim Fisk. So what Josie and Stokes did was to attempt to blackmail Fisk into continuing to pay Josie to keep those letters out of the hands of the newspapers.
You know, it's really interesting, H.W., because reading, I should say, the book contains a treasure trove of text lifted directly from some of these letters. Josie had been married off at 15 and had an abusive stepfather and didn't seem to have had much formal education. Someone very intelligent wrote the letters that she signed to Jim Fisk. Do you think that indicates that Ned was behind those letters?
I think Josie wrote those letters. Just because she had not a whole lot of formal schooling didn't actually set her apart that much from very many other people in that day and age, especially young women. So she might have had some help from Stokes, but it's entirely plausible that this was her writing. There are plenty of people who got their literary education reading the Bible, reading Pilgrim's Progress, reading newspapers. So I wouldn't put that beyond Josie.
Anyway, this finally comes to a head, and they go to court over this, which is really remarkable given the time and given the expectations that people had for particularly women in proper society.
Well, it was remarkable for the time, but also a great benefit to me, because the story all starts to come out when the trials begin. Because until the lawsuits go back and forth, then none of the letters, none of the intimate aspects of the relationship are made public. People know about them. They gossip about them. But no one has any occasion to report on them to her or to investigate them. But when Fisk sues Josie and Stokes for blackmail, and they countersue for withholding the money that she says Fisk owes her. Then the case goes to trial. And because these are big names in New York, Fisk is a big name. It would be as though Donald Trump were in the middle of a very messy trial.
Mm-hmm.
And because Boss Tweed was the most powerful person in New York, be like Michael Bloomberg got thrown into all of this, then reporters flocked to the trials. The trials first were civil lawsuit trials, and various people were brought to the witness stand. So a servant who had worked for Josie was sworn in and was asked about Ned Stokes and how often he would come to Josie's house and whether he would stay till late at night, whether there was any chaperone, whether there was anybody else around. Now, this individual had indeed been in the employ of Josie, but what made the testimony somewhat suspect was that Jim Fisk had hired this employee away from Josie at a much higher rate of pay. So this individual now worked for Jim Fisk and was testifying, in effect, on behalf of Jim Fisk. Josie eventually took the stand, and she was asked about her background. This is where what we know of Josie's background came out, because until this point, she had told various stories, and the stories really did vary from one version to another. But when she was sworn in and was testifying under oath, then stuff came out about her background that people hadn't known. And some of this suggested that she had been engaged in blackmail or extortion schemes as a teenager and perhaps had been pimped out by her stepfather. And so all of a sudden, Josie's reputation begins to shake a bit. And in fact, she is driven from the witness stand in tears, which of course makes the front page of all the papers in New York.
H.W. Brands is with us. He's Dixon Allen Anderson Centennial Professor of History at the University of Texas at Austin. His new book is called The Murder of Jim Fisk for the Love of Josie Mansfield, A Tragedy of the Gilded Age. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dixon Allen Anderson Centennial Professor of History at the University of Texas at Austin, H.W. Brands. His new book is called The Murder of Jim Fisk for the Love of Josie Mansfield, A Tragedy of the Gilded Age. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. So I guess we need to get here to this murder, H.W. So the business between Fisk and Josie is as yet unresolved. However, there is a grand jury considering an indictment against Ned Stokes for blackmail against Fisk.
Jim Fisk, operating with Boss Tweed, has been very good at subverting the legal system of New York. The judges in the New York system are unusual in that each court is an entity unto its own. And so people who are engaged in lawsuits would shop from one court to another trying to find a friendly judge, and the judge would be friendly in large part depending on who offered the highest price. So Fisk managed to get Stokes indicted for blackmail. Now, this was a serious matter. Until then, these had simply been civil lawsuits.
Mm-hmm.
Now it looked as though Stokes might go to jail. Now, Stokes was convinced that he was innocent, and he also was convinced that he was about to be railroaded by a purchased judge, a judge purchased by Fisk and Boss Tweed. And he became outraged at the idea of this. He had been on edge for weeks already. It's unclear whether he felt that he had been wronged by Fisk, whether he had a bad conscience for trying to blackmail Fisk, but it was quite clear that he was overwrought. And when the indictment was handed down, he had not expected this at all. In fact, his attorneys had said, there's no merit to the case, you're going to get off. And when the indictment was handed down, he believed that he was going to go to jail, and there was no way around it. In his outrage, he sought out Jim Fisk. He went to the headquarters of the Erie, and Fisk wasn't there. He went downtown to the largest and one of the newest hotels in New York, the Grand Central Hotel on Broadway. And he knew that Fisk had a habit of coming down there. So he lay in wait for Fisk at the head of the back stairway that Fisk often used. And he had only been there for a short while when Fisk indeed entered the building. And Fisk started up the stair, and Stokes pulled out a pistol. This apparently caught Fisk quite by surprise, because Fisk thought that there were certain rules to the game, that you could sue people, people could be bribed, but so far none of the affairs that he'd gotten involved in led to physical violence. And he was utterly nonplussed, and he didn't know what to do when Stokes pulled the gun. Stokes shot him twice. Fisk was a fairly heavy-set man, and one of the bullets hit him in the upper arm, and that's the bullet that people noticed first. Fisk fell on the second shot, and he fell to the floor. Stokes ran out of the hotel, at least tried to run out of the hotel. It was a very large hotel, and he had a long way to go. He had to run down another flight of stairs and through the hallway. And as he was doing it, people were yelling that somebody had been shot, somebody had been shot. And the porters of the hotel saw this guy dashing madly for the door, and so they figured, well, he might be the shooter. So Stokes just about made it out of the building, but he was turning a corner in front of the hotel barbershop, and there was a marble tile floor in front of the barbershop, and he slipped on the tile. He went down. He was getting up and just about out the door when the porters caught up with him and wrestled him to the ground. And so they hold him for the police. So it happened that there was a police station just half a block away, and the police came over quickly. Meanwhile, Jim Fisk was helped to a hotel suite at the top of the stair where he was shot. And he was laid down on a bed. And quickly, the bedclothes and the mattress were soaked in blood. And the people who brought him up there were amazed at this, because the only wound they saw was the one in his arm, and it didn't seem to be bleeding that much. And a little bit further investigation revealed that he had been shot in the abdomen. There were a number of residents at the hotel. People it took in out-of-town guests, but also it had residents. And among the residents were some physicians, and they were called to come take a look at Fisk. And they took one look, and they pronounced that his wound was probably fatal. In those days, a gunshot wound to the abdomen almost certainly would either cause the person who was wounded to bleed out immediately, or infection would quickly set in.
Yeah.
And in fact, that's what happened in Fisk's case. He survived overnight, but there was a striking moment when he was still alive, still conscious. The police brought Stokes, the assailant, into the room where Fisk was lying on the bed so that he could identify his assailant. But there was something curious that was supposed to happen here. In those days, and I don't know if this is still true in some jurisdictions, in those days, deathbed testimony was given special consideration, because the idea is someone was about to meet his maker, he wouldn't lie under those circumstances. But for it to qualify as deathbed testimony, you had to believe you were about to die. And so the person who was conducting the investigation asked Fisk, "Do you believe that you are dying?" And Fisk said, "Well, I hope not." But he was pressing him on it. You know, he wanted him to say, "Yeah, I'm going to die." And that way, the testimony would count extra. Well, Fisk didn't quite get that far, but he did identify Stokes. He said, "He's the one." And so the identification was made. Fisk survived overnight. His partner, Jay Gould, came and sat by the outside of the room, sort of keeping watch. No one could tell exactly why he was keeping watch. Was it to give comfort to Fisk as Fisk breathed his last, or was it to make sure that Fisk didn't reveal the secrets that they knew? And this question was applied even more to William Tweed, who showed up after most everybody had left. And he wanted to make sure. Well, he was friendly to Fisk, and his friend was dying, so that part was sincere. But he also wanted to make sure that Fisk didn't start spilling secrets to anybody who happened to be around, because reporters were all around the hotel, and they were getting daily updates, or getting hourly updates from the physicians. So Fisk survived overnight but died the next day, at which point Stokes now was charged with murder. And it took a while for the wheels of justice to turn. Stokes spent months in the Tombs, as the New York City jail was called. And eventually, a murder trial was held, and it proved inconclusive. Another murder trial was held. Another, third murder trial was held. Now, I'm not sure how much I should reveal about what exactly happened to Stokes.
We'll let people read the book for the final verdict.
There we go. Okay.
Let's go to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak to Byron in Oak Cliff. Hey, Byron.
Yes. Very interesting book. I saw a movie called The Toast of New York, a 1937 production.
Can I ask you how long ago you saw it?
Oh, it's been about 2 or 3 months ago.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, Turner Classic Movies.
Mm-hmm.
It was about the same guy, Jim Fisk. And Cary Grant played the Nick Boyd part. How much of your research was based or inspired by that movie?
It wasn't inspired by the movie at all. I have not seen the movie. I know that the movie exists. But actually, I got alerted to this story because I had been doing some research for a larger book on the Gilded Age. And so I knew about Fisk and Gould. And I knew about the Erie War, as the Battle for Control of the Erie Railroad was called. And I knew about the attempt to corner the gold market. And I knew that Fisk had been murdered suddenly. Now, for the purposes of my other book, that sort of ended the Fisk story, and I went on to larger themes. But I thought, well, this is kind of interesting. So I wondered how this came about and how it turned out. So that's how I originally got onto the story. As I say, I knew that the movie existed, but I never had occasion to see it. Was it a good movie?
Let's get Byron back on the line. Was it good, Byron?
Uh-huh.
Oh, good. Okay.
Of course, it might make you crazy at this point, HW, knowing the real story, because they always take liberties with these things.
Yeah, on the other hand, it gives me hope that Hollywood might decide they need another movie.
There you go.
They'll use my book as the basis for the screenplay.
I have to ask you about this, because you are an exceptionally prolific historian. Is a book like this, compared with, you know, you've written a lot of doorstoppers, is this like something that you crank out without much effort based on what you normally have to do, or is it just as painstaking to go through all those court records and letters and documents? So in other words, is this sort of like a dessert for you, or does this feel like a main course when you're writing a book like this?
Well, I wouldn't put it in terms of dessert or main course. What I would think is it's more like after you run a marathon, maybe the next day you want to run 3 miles instead of 26.
Yeah.
So after I've completed a big book, I usually try to write something a bit shorter. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that makes this all work for me is that I teach at the University of Texas, and I teach an introductory survey of American history every year. And so I'm thinking about these kinds of stories. And one of the things I do with my students, these are students who are not history majors for the most part. They're required to take the course. So I have to attract their attention and try to hold their attention. And I've discovered that the way to do this is to tell them stories. And so when I tell them a story like the story of Jim Fisk and Josie Mansfield and Ned Stokes, they listen. Hmm. People, students as well as older people, are wired for stories. So I knew the background. I knew the general outlines of the story. Now, when I was writing the book, I needed to go to the trial transcripts. I needed to go to the newspaper accounts. I needed to go to the contemporary recollections. So to get the detailed stuff, yes, it was the same kind of painstaking research, although I will say this, I really enjoy what I do, so I don't feel as though I'm taking pains exactly. But it is meticulous work. There's no question about that. One of the biggest difference, I suppose, is that this book is short, and my other books are long. So if this book is a fifth the length of some of my longer books, then in that respect, it probably takes about a fifth as much work.
It really is a fascinating sort of introduction, though, for people who don't know a lot about the Gilded Age, because you get curious about all these other figures that come in as sort of secondary characters.
Well, I hope that sort of thing happens, because I envision this book as something that a person who has no particular interest in history can pick up and just read it because I happen to think it's a good story. And one of the reasons I wrote this particular book is that it does include a number of trials. And in trials, while I was writing the book, I realized why the TV show Law and Order has been such a success over the years, and various other Perry Mason, all the ones that have courtroom scenes, because they're a perfect setup for establishing a drama. Because you have a protagonist, you have an antagonist, you have the back and forth. One of the hard things in writing historical nonfiction is getting the equivalent of dialogue.
Yeah.
But in a court scene, you have dialogue. The prosecutor says this, the witness says that. So it goes back and forth and back and forth. There's a whole lot more dialogue in this book than you usually see in works of history.
Does it make it easier for you as well to sort of really visualize these people, or is that a special gift that you have given what you do for a living?
What I try to do is find the voice of the individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, the voice is actually more important than what they look like. Now, these people came along at a time when photographs were available.
Yeah.
And in fact, when the three, Jim Fisk, Josie Mansfield, Ned Stokes, became notorious, then various photographers made a point of getting them to sit for photographs because they knew they could sell those photographs all over the place. But to me, the voice is more important than the picture because what I write are really word pictures of my characters. And I know I'm going to have photographs anyway. So Jim Fisk is on the cover, Josie Mansfield is on the back, and Ned Stokes is inside. So I don't need to describe them so much physically, but I need to get their voice so readers can hear Josie speaking. Now, technically, she's not speaking when she's writing her letters, but she is speaking when she's in court.
Mm-hmm.
And the court reporters were very good in those days. So you get it pretty much word for word, and you can tell when she speaks that her educational background, her general background, she grew up on the West Coast, is different from somebody like Ned Stokes. He came from a wealthy family. Josie came from, she was kind of working her way up. Jim Fisk is a New Englander. And so those sort of things come out in the voices that you hear, and I try to reproduce those in the book.
So Josie Mansfield lived to be almost 90 years old.
Amazing.
Yeah.
It's the most amazing thing. And one of the things that really got me about this story is when I started looking at it, and one of the things historians do is we try to find obituaries of people. And, of course, the obituary of Fisk was, well, he was the one who got murdered, so he dies first.
Oh, we've got about 15 seconds. I'm sorry.
Ned Stokes lives into the early part of the 20th century, but Josie lives forever, and she dies in Paris. And there's this, and I depict the funeral at the beginning of the book. And I just thought, well, how striking, how romantic, how eerie even. And that's what really hooked me to write the story.
It really is a great story. The new book is called The Murder of Jim Fisk for the Love of Josie Mansfield, A Tragedy of the Gilded Age. H.W., it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for making time for us.
My pleasure, Chris. Good to talk to you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.